on one of the two sajdas while performing an obligatory prayer, and when he remembers, he should perform the qada of the sajda, and also actually the sajda of sahw, you know. But discussions will follow. If inshallah we make time, we can talk about a forgotten tashahud and also forgotten sajda, because these are obligatory, and the qada of these, qada of tashahud, becomes obligatory. Not only the qada, but two sajda of sahw should also be performed. And then there is another example. When a person gives salam during the prayer while he should not give it, For example, in the second rak'ah, he has completed the tashahud, and then after tashahud, he
thinks that he ended.
This is the end of the prayer. He gives salam, and then all of a sudden he remembers that he should not have, given the salam, and he should not have recited the salam. So in that case, because he has done an extra salam, actually he has to perform two sajda of sahw.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away. La ilaha illallah,
Allahu Akbar. The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on Arabi English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about the rules of prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Before the break, I asked you, Sheikh Javid, about the sajda sahw. We all know that sajda means prostration and sahw is a mistake. And basically, it's a prostration that those people who say the prayer or offer the prayer need to correct their mistakes. But obviously, they cannot do it within the prayers, right?
Yeah.
So they have to do it afterwards. But how do they perform the sajda of sahw?
Well, the sajda of sahw, if a person performs two sajda using any zikr, it would be sufficient. But the religious authorities have mentioned a special zikr. For example, when a person, is supposed to perform two sajda of sahw, he can simply recite by saying, after making niyyah, he should perform, he should recite this zikr. Bismillah, billah, assalamu alaykum, ayyuhan nabiyyu, wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? This is the zikr of the sajda. And this zikr has to be recited
in both of the sajdas.
But if in the event that a person does not remember this zikr, because sometimes, you tend to forget sometimes, even I myself forget.
Yes.
So, I recite for example, any zikr, I recite Subhanallah, Rabbil Ala, Rabbil Ala, Bihamdi. And I recite.
Is it sufficient?
It is sufficient, because what is important is to perform the sajda, the act of sajda.
But and the recommended zikr is the one that you said.
That is recommended. And if you don't remember, if you happen to forget it, so you can recite the regular zikr that you usually recite during sajda.
So after the two sajdas, then they have to go to tashahud and salam.
They have to perform tashahud and then assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Okay,
and
thank you.
It's not necessary to say assalamu alaykum ayyuhan nabiyyu wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, assalamu alayna wa ala ibadihi. Only assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah. That's enough.
I see. Does a person, Sheikh Javid, have to do the sajda when he repeats himself after he realizes that he has made a mistake?
No, because he is supposed to go back and correct himself, and even though he has recited the same word twice, but this time he recites it correctly. In this scenario, it's not necessary to perform two sajda of sahw, because he has corrected himself.
I see. Sheikh Javid, if a person forgets one sajda or a tashahud, how is he supposed to go about it?
Well, just as I said, you know, as two sajda of sahw becomes obligatory for the forgotten tashahud and for the forgotten sajda, but there's also the qadha of the forgotten tashahud has to be done, and the qadha of the forgotten sajda should be done. And when you do the qadha, then you should quickly do the two sajda of sahw, and you should also do the same is the case with salam, you know, with the sajda. You should perform the sajda, and then after completing the sajda, you should perform two sajda of sahw.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, and does a person have to fulfill all the conditions of the qibla and tahara while performing the forgotten sajda or tashahud?
Of course, you know, when you remember that you forgot the tashahud, or you did not perform the salam of your the sajda, one of the sajdas of your prayer, mm-hmm. then you have to stand facing towards the qibla, and you should be in the state of tahara. Tahara is a must, and you should meet all the requirements, like the place where you stand should be clean. And the clothing and everything that you should be that you are wearing should be halal. So all those conditions which are required for an obligatory prayer must be fulfilled and must be present. Otherwise, the sajda will not be, you know, valid.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javed, for your nice contribution to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. I'm Muhammad Javed, signing off. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم من جاء لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
In the limelight. Three former Minneapolis police officers were found guilty on Thursday, 24th of February, of federal crimes for failing to intervene as another police officer killed George Floyd by pressing his knee on his neck for more than 9 minutes. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Tim Arango, Nicholas Bogle Burrows, and Jay Center. The piece is titled, Three former officers are convicted of violating George Floyd's civil rights. Three former Minneapolis police officers were found guilty on Thursday, 24th of February, of federal crimes for failing to intervene as another police officer killed George Floyd by pressing his knee on his neck for more than 9 minutes. The case was an extraordinarily rare example of the Justice Department prosecuting police officers for their inaction while another officer used excessive force. The verdict signaled to police departments across America that juries may become more willing to convict not just police officers who kill people on the job, but also those who watch them do it. A federal jury determined that the police officers, Tu Thao, a 36-year-old, Alexander Kueng, a 28-year-old, and Thomas Lane, a 38-year-old, had willfully violated George Floyd's constitutional rights by not providing medical care when he lost a pulse, and that two of them were also guilty of not intervening to stop a fellow police officer, Derek Chauvin, from planting his knee on George Floyd's neck. Mr. Kueng and Mr. Lane both helped Derek Chauvin restrain George Floyd while he was handcuffed face down on the pavement. Mr. Fowle stood nearby, keeping bystanders away. Derek Chauvin was convicted of murder last year and sentenced to 22.5 years imprisonment. The verdicts represented a significant victory for the Justice Department, which under the Biden administration has pledged to be more aggressive in prosecuting civil rights violations. It came just days after federal prosecutors secured hate crimes convictions against three white men in Georgia for the murder of Ahmaud Arbery, a black man who they chased and killed. Judge Paul Magnuson said he would allow the three men to remain free on bond until their sentencing hearing, which has not yet been scheduled. Mr. Lane and his lawyer shook their heads as the judge read the guilty verdicts. The other two defendants had no visible reaction. All three men and their lawyers were escorted from the courtroom by a U.S. Marshal. Judge Paul Magnuson has wide latitude to impose penalty and could sentence the three police officers to any amount of prison time, including life imprisonment. They still face state charges of aiding and abetting murder, with a trial scheduled for this year. Federal prosecutors had charged Derek Chauvin along with the other three officers, but he reached a plea agreement with the Justice Department in December, under which prosecutors said they would seek a 25-year prison sentence. George Floyd's relatives hailed Thursday's verdict. "I'm starting to feel like I can breathe again," said Philanese Floyd, a brother of George Floyd. He and Brandon Williams, George Floyd's nephew, said in the courthouse after the verdict that they hoped Judge Paul Magnuson would sentence all three former police officers to the maximum possible prison term. Legal experts and racial justice activists had been closely watching the case, saying it could have more ramifications for policing than even Derek Chauvin's murder convictions. At the heart of this case was a more widespread problem, experts say, than a single officer's act of violence. The tendency of police officers to stand by when they witness a fellow police officer committing a crime. The jurors' decision, which came after about 13 hours of deliberations following a month-long trial, suggested that they agreed with the prosecution's arguments that the police officers knew in the moment that Mr. Floyd was in severe medical distress and that Derek Chauvin was breaking the law. The verdict was also a rejection of the arguments cited in each of the three defense cases, that the police officers trusted Derek Chauvin, the senior police officer on the scene, and therefore were not aware that what he was doing was illegal. This case is believed to be the first time police officers have gone on trial for federal charges of failing to intervene against a more senior police officer who was using excessive force, according to Chrissy Lopez, a professor at Georgetown University Law Center. Chrissy Lopez has worked with police departments on training officers about their constitutional duties to step in when they see colleagues breaking the law. She said the guilty verdicts could significantly change law enforcement culture, compelling agencies to make sure that police officers are properly trained and are upholding their duties. "It forces you to move beyond the bad apple narrative," Ms. Lopez said. She added, "Now you're like, oh, everyone on the scene played a role in this." It shifts the entire narrative from misconduct being about just acts of commission to misconduct also being about acts of omission. Meanwhile, Attorney General Merrick Garland said the verdict showed that the police officers had violated the Constitution by not intervening. The Justice Department will continue to seek accountability for law enforcement officers whose actions or failure to act violate their constitutional duty to protect the civil rights of our citizens, Merrick Garland said in a statement. George Floyd should be alive today. During the trial, the defense lawyers tried to absolve the three officers, with Robert Paul, who represented Mr. Thowell, telling the jury during his closing statement that just because something has a tragic ending does not mean it's a crime. As George Floyd was being killed, Mr. Tao, a veteran officer who was Derek Chauvin's partner, was keeping a crowd of bystanders at bay. Mr. Lane and Mr. Kuang, both rookies, were helping Derek Chauvin detain George Floyd after a convenience store clerk said he had used a fake $20 bill to buy cigarettes. All three police officers, who along with Derek Chauvin were fired just a day after the killing, were charged with one count of failing to provide medical aid. Mr. Kuang and Mr. Thao were also charged with failing to intervene and stop Derek Chauvin's use of excessive force. Mr. Lane, who twice asked Mr. Chauvin if they should roll George Floyd on his side so he could more easily breathe, did not face that charge. The 12 jurors who decided the case were drawn from across Minnesota because the trial was over federal crimes and all 12 appeared to be white. That was in contrast to the more racially diverse juries drawn from the Minneapolis area that convicted Derek Chauvin and Kimberly Potter, the white police officer in a Minneapolis suburb who shot and killed a black man after mistakenly drawing her gun instead of her taser during a traffic stop. During this trial, prosecutors called to the witness stand doctors, police officers, bystanders, and a paramedic who arrived on the scene and said he believed that George Floyd was already dead. Prosecutors relied on the mountains of video evidence from bystanders, from the officers' body-worn cameras, from city surveillance cameras that provided an excruciating second-by-second record of the killing. One of the most important witnesses during the trial was Inspector Katie Blackwell, a Minneapolis police official who formerly was in charge of training. She testified for 3 days about the training that recruits receive on properly using force and on their constitutional duty to intervene when they see other police officers using excessive force. But the defense lawyers attacked Inspector Blackwell, arguing that the department failed in training officers to recognize when they have a duty to intervene, saying the discussion was perfunctory and little more than a word on a PowerPoint. While cross-examining her, Thomas Plunkett, the lawyer for Mr. Kuang, played the audio of a fiery speech Al Pacino gave while playing a football coach in the movie Any Given Sunday, a clip that was played for recruits at the police academy. Thomas Plunkett said his point was that the department promoted a cops versus the world mentality. The defense also tried to focus the jury's attention on the hierarchical and paramilitary aspects of police culture. How recruits are taught to obey superiors and carry out orders without questioning. Unlike Derek Chauvin, who did not testify at his trial, each of the three police officers took the stand in his own defense. They all said that they believed that Derek Chauvin, as the senior police officer, was in charge and knew what he was doing, and that they did not recognize that George Floyd was in the throes of a medical emergency. "I think I would trust a 19-year veteran to figure it out," Mr. Thao said. Mr. Kuang, who had Derek Chauvin as one of his field training officers, said, "He was my senior officer and I trusted his advice." To simplify things for the jury, the prosecutors often used the phrase, "in your custody, in your care," to describe the duty that police officers have to protect a detained suspect. In Derek Chauvin's trial last year, prosecutors similarly condensed their case for the jurors to the slogan, "Believe your eyes," arguing it was as simple as what they had seen in the harrowing bystander video. That video emerged from a group of ordinary citizens, young and old, whom by circumstance found themselves witnessing a murder outside a convenience store in South Minneapolis almost 2 years ago. Among them was Darnella Frazier, a teenager who was buying snacks with her young cousin and took out her cell phone to film the police officers struggling on the ground with George Floyd. Her video was the one that went viral, ricocheting around the world and drawing millions of people to the streets to protest police brutality in America. George Perry Floyd, a 46-year-old, was a black security guard and one-time rapper who had lost his job in the coronavirus pandemic. Derek Chauvin and Mr. Lane are white, Mr. Tao is Asian American, and Mr. Kuang is black. During the 4 weeks of the trial, family members of George Floyd and his girlfriend, Courtney Ross, who testified at Derek Chauvin's trial, were frequently seen in the court's gallery. The trial of Mr. Kuang, Mr. Lane and Mr. Tao on state charges of aiding and abetting murder is scheduled for this June. During their federal trial this week, state prosecutors who secured Derek Chauvin's conviction and are in charge of the state case against the three police officers were spotted in the audience taking notes.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Both Ukraine and Russia have suffered damage and casualties since Moscow's self-declared special military operation began on Thursday. Bombardment and shelling of Ukrainian cities continued on Monday. According to officials in Kiev, the Russian military struck Ukraine's second-largest city, Kharkiv, possibly killing dozens of civilians. But the Russian officials dismissed the reports of civilian deaths as not credible and part of a propaganda campaign launched by the West. The West has responded to the conflict by imposing several rounds of unprecedented sanctions on Russia, targeting its media outlets and its financial, banking, and energy sectors, among others, prompting Moscow to retaliate some of the measures. Russia says it will ride out the sanctions. The first Ukraine-Russia meeting in Belarus to reach a ceasefire concluded on Monday, with parties discussing the possibility of holding a second round of talks. Russia says it aims to, quote, denazify and demilitarize Ukraine. It also says NATO must withdraw from areas along or near Russian borders and that the West must formally recognize Moscow's control over the Crimean Peninsula.
The Russians are looking at this and seeing a redeployment of forces up to their borders from the Baltic states all the way to Korea. Bellicose rhetoric coming out of Washington on a daily basis for 5 years now. And they have to know this is, it's time for us to do something. President Putin said last week, you have a knife at our throat. We had to act. And that's the mentality there. It's entirely appropriate given the recent history and the long history of relations between the U.S., Russia, Germany, Poland, and the other players in this.
Crimea has been the point of contention between the West and Moscow since its repatriation to Russia following a referendum in 2014. The U.S. and its allies reject the outcome of the vote and consider the move as illegal. Russian President Vladimir Putin said to ensure its security, his country was left with no choice but to attack Ukraine. The country also says the conflict in its western neighbor roots back years.
This crisis broke out not as a result of the launch of the Russian special military operation in Ukraine, but much earlier, when for 8 years you turned a blind eye to the crimes perpetrated by the Ukrainian nationalists in Donbass. And again, today, you did not mention at all the suffering of the residents of Donbass.
The radical nationalists, according to Russian officials, are funded and aided by the West to create a buffer zone between the two sides. That comes on top of NATO's numerous war games near Russian borders, exercises the Kremlin has slammed as provocative. But those are not the only destructive measures the Western nations, especially the U.S., have taken. Former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from many international accords, including key treaties with Russia, and namely the Cold War-era Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, INF, and the Open Skies Treaty. The pacts were signed in the late 80s and early 90s as means to de-escalate tensions, risking to spiral into an all-out nuclear war.
The withdrawal of the U.S. from the INF and the Open Skies Treaty and all of that tend to undermine the kind of confidence that's required right now to avoid a war. That's the first thing that has to be considered. Secondly, is that in the absence of that treaty, of course, we can assume that one of the most violative of those treaty weapons are available or probably deployed and as close to Russia as possible. Russians, certainly, military planners have to assume that. And that, again, puts them on a hair trigger in terms of deciding whether or not to fire a defense against what looks like an incoming attack.
It appears we're getting there again. The president has ordered the military to put the nuclear deterrent forces on high alert, citing what he called unfriendly gestures made by the West. The French foreign minister had earlier warned that the bloc was a nuclear power. Although experts believe the threats about a nuclear confrontation are not to lose any sleep over, the fact of them being mentioned is worrisome to many. Washington says it doesn't want to be a part of a direct conflict with Russia. Why did it pick a fight with the power then if it wasn't willing to face the music?
North Korea says it launched a missile on Sunday as part of developing a reconnaissance satellite system. The North has not elaborated on the type of rocket used in the test, but authorities in South Korea say it appeared to be a ballistic missile, fired from an area near Pyongyang toward the sea off its east coast. The launch was the eighth this year and the first since the end of January when North Korea fired off a record number of projectiles, including its longest-range ballistic missile since 2017. North Korea has ramped up its missile testing in 2022, announcing plans to bolster its defenses against the United States and evaluating restarting all suspended military activities. North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, had previously stated that his country's weapons development is necessary for self-defense in the face of hostile policies from the United States, including sanctions and joint military drills with South Korea. The North has also vowed to strengthen its nuclear capabilities by building more powerful atomic weapons. The exact size and strength of North Korea's nuclear arsenal are unclear. Some estimates say North Korea could have around 200 nuclear weapons by 2027. Pyongyang is believed to have tested nuclear weapons several times. It has also tested ballistic projectiles capable of reaching the United States. But why does North Korea need this expanding military program?
They learned their lesson, in essence. They learned that the United States can't be trusted, and it is willing to commit just horrific crimes against the Korean people to secure its own interests. And so North Korea doesn't want to end up the same way that Iraq is, the way Palestine is, the way Afghanistan is, because of U.S. involvement, U.S. intervention.
Meanwhile, the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command said it was consulting with its allies, South Korea and Japan, about the latest test. The command said in a statement that the U.S. condemns the launch and calls on North Korea to refrain from further, quote, destabilizing acts. Following a series of North Korean missile launches, the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has imposed sanctions against Pyongyang. Washington has also called on the Security Council to take action against several North Korean individuals and entities accused of violating resolutions that ban North Korea's projectiles and nuclear weapons development. North Korean citizens continue to suffer because of the sanctions. The World Food Program has estimated that 10.1 million North Koreans are suffering from food shortages. Also, the UN has acknowledged that the US-backed sanctions were at least partly responsible for North Korea's food and medicine shortages.
The US sanctions against Korea have been devastating. It has significantly hurt the living standard of the people in North Korea. But with that in mind, they have pushed forward. They have continued on despite the difficult situation that they've been dealt because of U.S. foreign policy. You see that in their scientific advancements. You see that in their rebuilding of the nation after the Korean War. And you're seeing that now as they continue. Since the Trump administration continue to build newer and improve upon previous models of nuclear warheads.
Despite the sanctions, North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un is pursuing a plan for developing weapons that included hypersonic weapons, spy satellites, solid-fuel intercontinental ballistic missiles, and submarine-launched nuclear projectiles. Kim has intensified expanding his country's military capabilities since his diplomacy with former United States President Donald Trump ended without an agreement in 2019.
Well, I certainly hope that the U.S. is serious about improving relations, but I highly doubt it. I think perhaps the first thing that could be done is the U.S. removing its forces from South Korea, because you have to recognize that in a lot of ways, the Republic of Korea, or South Korea, is just a staging ground for U.S. and NATO forces to be right there on the demilitarized border of North Korea. And so if the U.S. is serious about improving relations, it should, in my opinion, completely withdraw from South Korea all forces.
Trump took unprecedented steps by initiating several rounds of dialogue with the North. However, Washington blew what Pyongyang called a golden opportunity. The United States, Britain, Europe, and Canada moved to block certain Russian banks' access to the SWIFT international payment system as part of more sanctions against Moscow as it continues its military operation against Ukraine.
We are resolved to continue imposing massive costs on Russia, costs that will further isolate Russia from the international financial system and our economies.
The measures, which will also include restrictions on the Russian central bank's international reserves, will be implemented in the coming days.
We will paralyze the assets of Russia's central bank. This will freeze its transactions, and it made it impossible for the central bank to liquidate assets.
Von der Leyen said removing Russia from SWIFT will paralyze Russia's international trade and effectively stop its imports and exports. Earlier, Berlin announced it has agreed to limit Moscow's access to SWIFT as well. The SWIFT system is a Belgian cooperative that offers many services in assisting businesses and individuals to complete seamless and accurate business transactions. Western countries have joined the chorus as well. The US says Western nations will also impose restrictive measures on the Russian Central Bank to prevent it from deploying its international reserves in ways that undermine the impact of sanctions. But how much damage will these sanctions have on the fragile global economy? The sanctions add to the economic impact of this crisis and will transmit primarily through energy prices as well as grain prices. Russia and Ukraine supply crops to a long list of countries around the world, including large volumes to buyers in the Middle East and Africa. Sanctions will also add to a growing concern of inflation. This could throw the EU economy into mayhem or even negatively affect Russia's gas supplies to Europe. The EU is Russia's biggest trade partner. Nearly 38% of Russia's exports went to the EU, while over 36% of Russia's imports came from Europe. Russia is also the origin of 26% of the EU's oil imports and 40% of the EU's gas imports. The world energy market and commodities have been affected and will continue to witness price surges, especially when it comes to oil. On Thursday, oil prices briefly topped $100 for the first time since 2014. The US and several of its allies, including the European Union and the United Kingdom, have vowed to impose further restrictions on Moscow as punishment. In total, the sanctions will keep approximately $1 trillion in Russian banking assets from flowing through the markets of the US and its partners' financial systems. The sanctions also limit tech exports to Russia and squeeze the country's tech industry. Those sanctions are the main foreign policy tool of Americans. The effectiveness of this tactic is debated. The sanctions already announced are significant in size and scope, but the long-time American reliance on sanctions has left the US with few other options if Russia does not respond. Experts say Russia's sanctions are a big deal, but it could take quite a while, even years, for the sanctions to hurt the Russian economy.
They think they can destroy Russia and China by cutting them off. They cannot. It's a false dream. And it, unfortunately, if they continue, it probably will lead to war, perhaps nuclear war, and the annihilation of the human race.
Russian officials dismiss Western sanctions as ineffective. Russia's GDP has grown yet at a slow rate since the West imposed financial sanctions on Russia in 2014. The country's officials also point to low inflation, the minimal budget deficit, a public debt of only 18% of GDP at the end of 2020, steady current account surpluses, and international currency reserves of $596 billion at the end of 2020. Russians have got used to sanctions and therefore adapted their economy to them.
Almost 2 years after African-American George Floyd died beneath the knee of a white police officer on a street in Minneapolis, the police officers involved are being brought to account. A federal jury has found three former officers present at the scene of Floyd's arrest guilty of depriving the man of his civil rights. The jury found the conduct of the three officers led to Floyd's death, a charge that would impact the final verdict the officers will face. The three are convicted of failing to stop Derek Chauvin, who knelt on Floyd's neck for about 9 minutes, and denying Floyd's constitutional right to medical care while in custody. Tu Tao, Alexander Quang, and Thomas Lane will remain free on bail until their hearings, which aren't scheduled yet. What's for certain is that they'll face several years in prison. Chauvin, the officer arresting Floyd, was sentenced to 22 and a half years last year. For Floyd's family, it's not enough.
This is just accountability. It can never be justice because I can never get George back. And no matter how many times that I pray at night and I think about my brother 24/7, it still is going to be hard, even though We just had a federal conviction, and we already had the state conviction. But times, you know, will be probably a lot harder for me still because I can't get my brother back.
The trials are considered historic in the U.S., where officers are hardly ever indicted for the treatment of the members of the black community. Racism in the United States dates back as long as its history. The African Americans have suffered tremendous atrocities at the hands of white slave owners over the years, and the impact it made on American society can be observed to this day. One of the early cases of police racism can be traced back to the early 1700s when South Carolina launched America's first law enforcement force, dubbed the Slave Patrol. As the title suggests, the patrols were tasked with hunting down black people and selling them into slavery. Following a devastating civil war, slavery in the U.S. was abolished in 1865, but the results the anti-slavery camp was looking for didn't come to pass. Wealthy plantation owners in the South found loopholes in the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution and created what later became known as the Black Codes, the rules and regulations that appeared to have acknowledged the abolition but created the same slavery conditions in essence. Among the many racist provisions in the codes is the criminalization of vagrancy for black people. This meant that law enforcement was free to arrest and charge any black person who didn't have a job. The codes were a precursor to Jim Crow laws, which enforced racial segregation in the South and lasted until the mid-20th century. The recent killings and mistreatment of the black people are reminiscent of the lynching of African Americans and the destruction of their properties by the Ku Klux Klan and other hate groups throughout the years.
So I guess the main root is, you know, this country has been founded on a system of white supremacy, racism, and genocide. It's founded on a system of inequality with a purpose, right? Racism with a purpose. The purpose is to create a group of second class citizens who the country can feed off of, right? We can feed off of their labor, we can feed off of their work, we can feed off of their existence.
U.S. President Joe Biden staked much of his presidency on a promise to fight racism in the country, managing to garner the support from a large portion of the African American society. But with many lawmakers balking at even the idea of police reforms, can the president make good on his pledge?
You know, police reform and police brutality is a big issue for black and brown folks and for poor and working class folks here in the United States. But the U.S. politicians don't represent those people or those interests in this country. They represent a rich interest, the rich interest of the ruling class. And so, you know, they're not interested in police reform. So this bill, you know, essentially has died in the Senate and will probably never get passed because of the fact that, you know, there's no interest by U.S. policymakers to get it passed. There's no interest to do what the citizens want them to do.
George Floyd wasn't the first African-American who lost his life over what could otherwise be considered as an inconsequential offense for a white person, and certainly has not been the last. But the waves of scrutiny such cases bring up in their wake are indeed making a positive, albeit limited, impact.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Islamic housing. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of Islamic housing. According to the teachings of Islam, we know that the Prophet ﷺ has stopped us from making houses out of showing off and or to become popular, because there are some people who try to make house or who buys the house in order to become famous, like in the town, like such person has such and such house, or maybe it is to show off to the people. And the Prophet has said that whoever makes such a house, on the day of judgment, Allah will take this house 7 levels down in the earth, and after that, in the shape of a necklace, a fire necklace, it will come up, and it will be hanged on the neck of the person who owns it. And this is the hellfire, basically. Why? Because he made a house out of, we can say, like, for the popularity. He made it to show off to others. It wasn't the need of the person. And therefore, when Prophet said so, the companions asked that, "O Prophet, how should be the house then?" فَقُلْنَا يَا رَسُولَ اللَّهِ The companion said, "How, O the Prophet, كَيْفَ يَبْنِي رِئَاءً وَالسُّمْعَةً? How is the showing off, and how is the being, you know, for the popularity?" The Prophet said, "If يَبْنِي فَضْلًا عَلَى مَا يَكْفِيهِ أَوْ يَبْنِي مُبَاهَاتٍ, if someone builds something which is more than the things which he needs, it is more than ma yakfihi, he needs it, if it is more than that, aw yabni mubahat, or he makes it for something which he does not need, then this comes under the category where Allah will punish this person." Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of Islamic housing, and we said that the Prophet has stopped people from making house in order to show off, in order to get the popularity, or anything which is excessive for him. Why it is so? It is because when we look at the Islamic teachings, Islam pays attention towards the justice, to the social justice. In an Islamic society, in a religious society, when the main slogan of Islam, when the main goal of Islam is to get people towards, or take people towards the justice, towards the social justice in its Islamic meanings, not the general meaning that which generally is said in the world, but in its true Islamic meaning, then obviously if someone owns something which he does not need, if someone performs something which is against the justice, which is against the teachings of Islam, then obviously he is accountable for it. And there are strict verses about such people that Allah will definitely punish such people on the day of judgment. And therefore, when Islam talks about the equality of the people, when, you know, when we go to the mosque and when we stand for prayer, in one line we can see the rich, the politician, the leader, the beggar, for example, or the needy, or a poor person, a middle class person, they all are standing in one line behind the imam. And this one line shows us in the prayers that you all are equal. You all are equal. And you all should not excess the limits. You should not break the limits which are set by Islam. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
that he does have ties to Muslim extremists. I don't know.
U.S. President Joe Biden delivered a speech in defense of withdrawing American troops from Afghanistan.
To those asking for a third decade of war in Afghanistan, I ask, what is the vital national interest? In my view, we only have one: to make sure Afghanistan can never be used again to launch an attack on our homeland.
The withdrawal was chaotic, but the president had taken his bold decision and stance. Now, more than 1 year into Biden's presidency, this boldness looks like a temporary aberration in U.S. foreign policy. The White House has followed a foreign policy that is unclear on core issues. This chaotic approach has shown itself most vividly in the Biden administration's effort to revive the Iran nuclear deal, known also as the JCPOA.
It's not time to give up. There is some progress being made. The P5 plus one is on the same page, but it remains to be seen.
In his presidential campaign in 2020, Biden left little doubt concerning the deal. In an op-ed for CNN, he wrote, "If Iran returns to strict compliance with the nuclear deal, the United States would rejoin the agreement as a starting point for follow-on negotiations." But in practice, Biden has shown indecisiveness so far. For months, the U.S. president and his team debated whether to enter the JCPOA or to seek a new agreement. After the administration decided to re-enter, it began an after-you game with Iran, laying out a set of conditions and asking Tehran to make the first move, which Tehran rejected outright.
I have to tell you, recent moves, recent rhetoric, don't give us a lot of cause for optimism. Even though the hour is getting very late, it is not too late for Iran to reverse course and engage meaningfully in an effort to return to mutual compliance with the JCPOA.
The Iranians say since the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the deal, it ought to take the first move, meaning to lift sanctions and to unfreeze Iran's financial assets. Moreover, given Biden's predecessor's unpredictability, the Iranians want the White House to guarantee that it won't repeat what Trump did in 2018 when he pulled out of the deal. That said, when it comes to nuclear agreements, the Americans never follow through on their word. For example, in 1994, the U.S. signed the framework agreement with North Korea to end its nuclear program, but the U.S. never lived up to its obligations under the deal, which included the construction of a light water nuclear reactor and normalizing diplomatic relations, and Pyongyang walked away. Or in the case of Libya, Muammar Gaddafi voluntarily gave up his nuclear program, but that didn't stop the U.S. from actively supporting forces who toppled his government and brutally killed him.
Of course, the big news this week, Gaddafi's dead, rebel forces, killed by rebel forces. Your reaction, your take on this?
Well, this is somebody who for 40 years had terrorized his country, had supported terrorism, and he had an opportunity during the Arab Spring to finally let loose of his grip on power and to peacefully transition to democracy. We gave him ample opportunity, and he wouldn't do it.
Trump's withdrawal from the Iran deal is just the latest case. Against such a backdrop, demanding even more concessions from Tehran does not seem to be the wisest move to revive the deal.
We are very clear-eyed about the hurdles that remain. These talks will be structured around working groups that the EU is going to form with the remaining partners in the JCPOA, including Iran. And the primary issues that will be discussed are the nuclear steps that Iran would need to take in order to return to compliance with the JCPOA.
Since most of the sanctions on Iran are based on executive action, there is nothing stopping Biden from going back into the deal. But it seems that Biden is unwilling to upset Iran hawks on Capitol Hill, in particular Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey, who is the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Since Menendez is a vocal critic of the Iran nuclear deal, Biden is reportedly afraid of provoking him because he would block or slow roll the administration's foreign policy nominees. As Matt Duss, foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders, put it, they don't hate the deal because it's a bad deal. They hate the deal because it's a deal with Iran. Full stop. On the JCPOA, there is no consensus to be built with the anti-Iran hawks. The enmity towards Iran is partly due to pressure from powerful interest groups, including the pro-Israel lobby. As Bill Clinton's Middle East envoy Kenneth Pollack once said, from a political standpoint, nobody pays a price to be tough on Iran.
And this is the same spirit that, you know, I want to bring to our relationship of cooperation, of goodwill, of friendship. We're going to be talking about a bunch of issues, primarily how do we fend off and curtail Iran's pursuit to dominate the region.
Israel's security is and always will be unshakable. And we look forward to addressing all of these challenges that we face, particularly regional security and the deep concerns that we share about Iran and the role that it's playing in the region, including its nuclear program.
It's very unlikely that Biden will be able or at least willing to defy this lobby. When Barack Obama came into office, he tried to ease mistrust between Tehran and Washington through a series of peacemaking gestures, such as addressing the Iranians on their new year or writing letters to the leaders of Iran.
So in this season of new beginnings, I would like to speak clearly to Iran's leaders. We have serious differences that have grown over time. My administration is now committed to diplomacy that addresses the full range of issues before us and to pursuing constructive ties among the United States, Iran, and the international community.
But he finally gave in to pressure from then-Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and as a result adopted anti-Iran policies by imposing sanctions on the country. It was just late in his presidency when he decided to reach an agreement with Iran. Biden, who was Obama's vice president, is now confronted with a similar anti-Iran scenario. Recently, about 200 House Republicans wrote to Biden warning any nuclear deal made with Iran without Congress approval will meet the same fate as the 2015 agreement by Obama, which was later abandoned by Trump. On the other hand, Biden's plunging approval rating has made the administration more timid in its approach to international affairs. Biden is afraid of the backlash from appearing to make concessions to the Islamic Republic. In the words of Jeffrey Lewis of the Middlebury Institute of International Studies, Biden is a wimp. He would have taken a political hit for taking a chance on the Iranians that might or might not have worked out, but it would have put the ball in Iran's court. Trump is gone, but his Iran policy is still in place. If the Biden administration wants to be more than a historical footnote on U.S. foreign policy, it needs to be more decisive. It needs to take action on decisions it has adopted rhetorically. The clock is ticking.
IRIB English Radio.